Why don't we start you two? Let's just introductions. Tell us who you are and what you do.
Sure. My name is Chris Sell. For a while, I was a police officer here in Juneau for about 20 years. Retired just about a year and a half ago and moved to Montana, where I'm from.
All right. And you, sir?
I'm Saul Neely, Associate Professor of English and Philosophy at UAS, and I started a prison education program called the Flying University that brings university students inside the prison for mutual and collaborative study.
All right.
So you can tell we have so much in common. I mean, why wouldn't we be friends?
This is kind of why I invited you here. I saw this post that Saul did on Facebook. Saul, could you actually just start by reading that for us, please?
I will.
Do you need your glasses?
No.
I can get mine.
I'm good. I think it's funny, though, because I thought maybe I wouldn't see you again after that one time at Fred Meyer.
Were you hoping you weren't going to see me again, Saul?
Well, I actually
you haven't
was.
Started reading yet. So.
I was, but this is funny. You know, I saw you at Fred Meyer Tuesday morning, and it was really nice to run into you. I was surprised. And I went to campus, and I wrote this Facebook post, and I didn't name you in it, but people clearly knew it was about you, and it, like, within 24 hours had almost 130 likes.
Well, now I'm super bummed you didn't accept my Facebook friend request.
Oh, no.
No, I'm joking. I didn't send you one. I just wanted to throw you under the bus.
And so this is it. I wrote, here's a story, and it's true. There was a police lieutenant at Juneau Police Department who I met a few years back. We first met during the early days of the Juneau Reentry Coalition, when it was still community-driven and grassroots. We clashed severely. I couldn't stand her, and she couldn't stand me. She was tough on crime and didn't have any patience for somebody like me. Absolutely every time we met, I would shake with some blend of anger and frustration, especially when she would speak against me in public, even if it was indirect and veiled. I could be my own paranoia. In those early days of JREC, she quit coming, but later, once JREC was reorganized under DOC, she began to regularly attend. We worked together for a year and a half, during which time she saw how difficult reentry is. She began to say, I've literally put thousands of people in jail, but I've never been there once when they got out. Over a year and a half, her whole perspective changed. She became a committed ally of our justice reform efforts. She put her own career in jeopardy to fight the good fight, as she would say. Her perspective was entirely reformed. She retired a while back, but she's in town, and I had the pleasure of running into her this morning. When people actually listen to the stories of our incarcerated neighbors, their abstract bluster about getting tough on crime dissipates. Such radical transformation feels like nothing less than a miracle, and I have nothing but the highest levels of respect now for this police lieutenant. To my mind, it is the highest level of courage that an officer can demonstrate. And
oh, yeah, who could that have been about, Saul? So cool you didn't name me.
I didn't name you. And then I got all these private Facebook messages, too. Like, I know who you're talking about. Well, of course we do, but.
Chris, can you give us some context? Take us back to when you and Saul first met and some of your perspectives revolving incarceration and reentry.
Absolutely. Now you've dropped a nickel in me. I hope you're ready. So like a lot of people, I was first exposed to news when tough on crime was the idea of the 80s. And I started paying attention to news reports. And of course I wanted to be tough on crime. Who wouldn't want to be tough on crime? That seems like just a principle we should all be able to agree on. And when I got older, heavily influenced by my uncle who was a sheriff, I decided that that principle of protecting people from those who would prey upon them was so important to me, I would lay down my own life to defend it. I would become a police officer, and should it be necessary to protect people from criminals, I would make that sacrifice. And so this was really my North Star principle. And protecting people still is. That hasn't changed. But what happened is I was working my way through my 20 years of law enforcement is that I started to see things that were difficult to reconcile with some of our traditional theories of teaching people a lesson and punishing them so they would know not to do it again. And it was hard to let go of those because I was raised like that. I remember my parents telling me, it doesn't matter why you did that, and here are the consequences. And it worked. I mean, I had a moral compass. But working in law enforcement, I saw the same people getting arrested over and over again. I was arresting the same people over and over again. I was arresting members of the same family through generations. Mm. And as I pulled people out of more and more dire circumstances, after the first arrest, they've lost their house. And then by the time they get arrested a second time, they've lost their family. And by the fifth or sixth arrest, they're living in a moldy camper or a car in Juneau. And I had to ask myself, do I really believe that this is happening to this person because they're too stupid to get it? Mm-hmm. Or are they still getting arrested because they're still a drug addict? Are they getting arrested because they're still mentally ill and that's not being addressed? As I go through the backpacks of people I've arrested and the S is backwards when they tried to write their own name, mm-hmm. do I really believe this person can read and has options about being a productive, law-abiding citizen? And that became impossible for me to ignore. And I'm arresting people while they still have the release paperwork in their pocket from the last time they were in jail. And I'm seeing the statistics that getting close to 70% of the people who were incarcerated are going back. So clearly something's not working, and yet that comforting principle, that simple principle of teaching people a lesson and being tough on something that's so horrible still drew me in. And I struggled with that. And as I was exposed to more of the science and had to spend what felt like countless hours with irritating people like Saul Neely, who as a philosophy professor is kind of at the different end of the spectrum from the pragmatic way I'm trying to address things. And we're starting to learn. And I would like to think that Saul also learned some things from the fact that my fear that as we kept arresting people and they got more and more desperate, they were getting more violent towards people like me and other officers. Other officers I would take a bullet for. And he understood that. And we realized, I think, slowly that we were trying to get to the same place mm-hmm. where the community is safe and people are not committing crimes because it's in nobody's best interest to have that happen. But we had different ways of coming about that. And as we talked and we had it was sometimes adamant disagreement. Mm-hmm. It was respectful disagreement. And it wasn't personal, it wasn't nasty, and it wasn't overly simplified. We didn't turn complicated issues into bumper sticker slogans because that's a sure way to make sure you don't come to any agreement. And what Saul had that I couldn't see was, how do we do this better? Because I was frustrated. I could see the same relatively simple tools were not working, and Saul slowly brought in things that had worked and how personal that was for each individual and that there's no template and there's no checklist that's going to work for every person. And he stayed hopeful. You know, he's one of the most hopeful people you'll ever meet. And I would get frustrated. And I know that we're still wrestling with so many of these issues and we probably will for our lifetimes. And the really complicated part is I have observed, because I have addicts in my own family, people who are violating the law in my own family, the closer the issue is to me personally and emotionally, the more likely I am to come full circle back to wanting to punish them.
Interesting.
And back to being angry at them. I can sit down in a professional mindset with an addict and talk about, you know, what inspired you to get better. And when you went to Saul's class, what really touched you about that? Because I want to support the things that are working because it's important for our safety. And yet when it gets close to me personally, I can't think rationally. And so when you're weighing in with the really valid stakeholders in criminal justice, the ones who have been harmed by criminals mm-hmm. – there's a different component to it, and it affects me too. I mean, these family members, I can't sit down with them and have a rational conversation. Mm-hmm. What the damage they're doing to people that love them hurts me so much mm-hmm. that I go back to that comforting, wanting to punish them and wanting them to learn a lesson. And a little voice in my head is saying they need to just decide they're going to stop doing heroin. Mm-hmm. When every part of my reasoning brain knows that you don't just decide to stop doing heroin. It's much more complicated than that. So I look to people like Saul to kind of then influence me back into the science that there are things that work. It's not hopeless. And he just keeps working away at people like you know, glacier wearing away mountains. He just is relentless and hopeful, and he keeps showing up.
So what are some perspectives that you've learned from Chris over the years or learned from her and her colleagues that you may not have known when you first met?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think the key with like the Reentry Coalition, what was so neat about that is over the year and a half, I think it was about a year and a half where we were all really working together, coming together every month for the reentry. We just got to know each other's stories a little bit better, and that really humanizes people. I mean, I think this discussion right now and the Facebook post I made about Chris Sell is what our community needs, is stories like this where we can actually learn to communicate and listen to one another and learn from one another, even when we come at things from pretty radically different starting points. And I think, you know, what I really learned from, I think, Chris is to think about, you know, how concrete is my work? You know, am I being too abstract? Am I sometimes, you know, just coming from an ideology that's not sufficiently rooted in the concrete difficulties and violences and issues of people's lives? I mean, we were both working in trenches, but from different kinds of trenches, you know, and just having that kind of respect because the 80s tough on crime stuff. I mean, I was living in Georgia. I graduated high school in 91, and that was the height of the war on drugs. And I saw, like, from my side, you know, I think it took me years to sort of shed a mild kind of trauma every time I would see a cop car. You know, I mean, it was just my heart would start racing, and that was hard to get over. But I think when my wife and I first moved to Alaska in 96, the Anchorage Police Department had baby blue colored cars. We used to call them the baby blue meanies. Sorry. But being in the community here and getting to know Chris just changed my perspective on all of that as well. And understanding that, you know, police officers are rooted, they're community members. And that was coupled with the fact that, you know, when I first met Chris and we clashed in the Juneau Reentry Coalition, and I would go to the airport and I would hear her voice on the airport PA system, you know, and I was like, oh, God, it's Lieutenant Sell. But, you know, like 2 years later, I'm driving down the car and I hear on the radio and I'm like, Mila, beat my daughter. I'm like, Mila, be quiet. I got to hear this. And I turn it up and I would just listen to everything you'd say. And I'm like, that's it. That's brilliant. Yes. Thank you for saying that on the radio. And I just thought that was a lot of courage. And I really do mean that. I know it takes courage for people to become police officers and put their life on the line every day. I get that. But there's a qualitatively different kind of courage, I think, too, when you open yourself up to shifts in perspective. And that's a courage that I think we're largely lacking in our community. This is why on Tuesday night's event for Flying University, we called it Courage for Community, because I think the political moment right now is so characterized by fear. All this work we committed to together with Tali Ames, Christina Love, Kara Nelson, you know, we worked hard to push social, you know, the prison reform. And that's all being pulled back right now. And it's being pulled back not out of data, not out of evidence, but just fear. And I think that's one of the biggest, most tremendous inspirations I get from my relationship with Chris Sell is mustering that kind of courage. It's a different kind of courage.
So I think one of the most valuable things I got out of being involved on committees with Saul, where we were on such different perspectives, is that we did learn to listen to each other and not dig in because of words that were used or just having an emotional reaction to the other person's perspective. Like, at this point, after a year and a half, I can say things to Saul like, there are times mandatory arrest and zero tolerance works. Now, normally he would be like, come on, you know, you can't mean that. But zero tolerance and threatening people works for DWI, because a lot of your prospective DWI drivers are not addicts and they're not mentally ill. And even after four drinks in downtown Juneau, they can still think about the risks they're taking and the consequences that might happen. And we can scare them into taking a cab. And they can see people's name in the newspaper and still realize after four drinks, hey, I don't want that to be me this weekend. So I'm not going to run that risk. And mandatory arrest for domestic violence absolutely works because it interrupts the DV cycle. It gives the victim a chance to think before the abuser can suck them right back into a honeymoon phase. And so it's being willing to hear ideas of value from someone coming from a different place. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's been a great relationship. I feel like we learned a lot over a year and a half. I don't think it was always fun and it wasn't always pleasant. But if you can have a respectful dialogue about an issue that is so incredibly complicated, and that's the real challenge here, is there are no simple answers. If somebody's giving you a simple answer or a slogan for a problem like this, they are manipulating you because that's not honest. You can't take something this complicated and give somebody a simple, comforting answer. It's fun when that happens. I mean, let's get tough on crime, zero tolerance, and those feel good. And I get that. And there's a lot of reasons that those do feel good. But this issue is about people. Mm-hmm. And I mean, look at how complicated our cars are. Well, a person is exponentially more complicated than a car. And you need really complicated tools and sometimes expensive tools to deal with what's going on with that person. And as we talked about reentry, I think we developed almost a shared dream that when someone enters the criminal justice system, that somebody, hopefully in pretrial or a probation officer, would find out, why is this person here? Mm-hmm. Why did this person commit a crime? Are they addicted? Are they mentally ill? Can they not read well enough to fill out a job application and they're trying to provide food? Because you can look at all of those people having committed exactly the same crime of theft and say, I want to apply this cookie cutter answer to it. But the things that are needed to keep that person from doing it again are worlds apart. And so it's asking people to get more sophisticated, because it's dangerous to have a permanently criminalized portion of your population. I have met people who are doing life in prison on the installment plan right here in Juneau, and they are dangerous because they don't have any hope. They're just biding their time till they get out and commit more crimes, and that makes all of us less safe walking down the street. And Saul doesn't want that, and I don't want that. And we're going to have to get really serious about talking about what to do about it.
Yeah, that's right. And having to come up with sophisticated responses, I was testifying, I forget which one, SB 34. It's one of these four crime bills up right now going through the legislature. And I was sitting in the chambers and I'm listening to people call in their testimony, and I hear over and over this refrain, the same refrain. And I later heard that there might have been a church somewhere in the state of Alaska that was giving people these talking points. But the talking point was, people who support SB 91 care more about the perpetrators than the victims. They don't care about the victims. They don't care about the victims. And so because I was signed up late for the testimony, I was able to revise what I had planned on saying. And what I ended up saying was, look, to say that those of us who support criminal justice reform don't care about victims is just wrong. Like what you said, it's dishonest. We care deeply about victims, but we also understand that in our community, it's not so easy to separate victims from perpetrators, because a lot of the perpetrators of the crime and the violence are themselves victims. you know, of something, transgenerational trauma, racism, child abuse, you know, when they were kids. You know, the story I like to tell is our first Flying University publication, one of the inmates published a poem in which he talked about how his dad locked him in a freezer as a kid to see if he would freeze, or threw him against the wall to see if he would break. And it's like, man, it's no wonder you grew up and became violent. It's like, what else do you know? And so it's hard just to say that you're a perpetrator and not also at the same time a victim. And I think that what Chris is talking about is the complexity and the sophistication that's needed to intervene at that level, you know, and to hear her talk about arresting same family members across generations. I mean, that's kind of the same thing. It requires a thoughtful intervention and resources. It is expensive. But if we really think about it, there's no shortage of resources in this community, in this state, in this nation.
And very literally, I've had the experience of participating in arresting a young woman for drugs who was the victim of really shocking serial abuse by her mother through her childhood. And as a young officer, I worked the cases against her mother. And then as she got to be an adult, I'm working the cases against her. And I've had a ringside seat to that, which I have tried to bring to some of these organizations, some of the views that we have actually doing the work on the street. But even further than looking at the victim that this person has had, what we also during SB 91 asked people to think about is this was a terrible thing that happened to this victim and we care deeply about that. But if we don't effectively intervene, which some people feel like is too gentle because it's training, what about this person's next six victims? If we don't effectively treat them, their body count just keeps rising. And it may not literally be a body count. It might be a shopkeeper they've stolen from or a car that they've taken or somebody that they've assaulted. But when you have a lifetime criminal, they are racking up victims unless you use the North Korean model and just lock everybody up for 99 years for even the smallest crime. But that's not what we're going to be doing. So as people come out, are they becoming more violent, more dangerous, and more committed to a criminal lifestyle every single time? So I don't think you should in any way discount the feelings of people who have been victims of those crimes. But I also want you to imagine the future victims of this criminal. And that's why we want effective intervention. It's not to hug them better or all the things that sometimes people are accused of when they want to do that kind of intervention. It's because we don't want there to be future victims.
Chris, remind us how many years you were on the force?
Sure. And I'm retired from JPD now. I'm not speaking for JPD, and I never did. It was always something I did as part of independent commissions. The administration of JPD often had different perspectives on it. And at this point, I'm speaking for myself. I've been retired for about a year and a half. I served starting in 1997, and I retired at the end of 2017, at the end of Year of Kindness, which was something I enjoyed more than anything I ever did. Otherwise. And retirement is great. I highly recommend it.
As through that 20 years here in Juneau, and as you were coming to some of these realizations about justice reform, were there challenges for you with colleagues, with the department, of corrections? Were you having to communicate these ideas to your coworkers? How did that all go?
I can probably illustrate that best by a conversation I had with an officer who was not with the Juneau Police Department, who was with another agency, and was talking about, I've got this case and it's going federal and the consequences are so severe, this person's going to immediately plead out to get the best situation they can. And he said, I consider that a victory. And I asked him, so what are the chances this person's going to continue to commit crimes when they do eventually get out? I mean, what are we looking at for recidivism for these really heavy federal offenses? And he said, oh, I don't know. I've never looked at that. And so it's two valid viewpoints from different areas. It's like two people looking through the tube from a roll of paper towels. And you can see only what you're paying attention to in that case. And, you know, I don't know if that's something that he added to his analysis of whether or not his the cases he was working were being effective for the community or not. And it's not that there are viewpoints that the chiefs of police or the JPD administration had that were invalid, but they were different. And what information are you looking at and what are you processing? And it is such a complicated issue with so many valid viewpoints that coming to the consensus is what we're struggling with now. And you have to have a respectful discourse to do that, because when everybody digs in, we just get more clashing and we don't get any closer to the consensus. And consensus building is not super exciting for headlines.
Right.
You know, you never see a headline in the paper. It's like so-and-so carefully found areas of agreement and crafted this beautiful solution. I mean, you're never going to see that in bold print on the front page of the newspaper. And so in a lot of ways, the extremes get rewarded for being extreme and for not listening to other viewpoints. And that just drives wedges in between us. It just makes things so much harder. And I hope that we can make respectful disagreement more popular.
Right. I think it's always three things: the evidence and the data, courage, and respect. That's what it takes.
And this is probably a really big question, Saul, but where do we need to go from here?
I think this is my perspective. I think that we need to continually return to the data and the evidence, for one, that shows that building rich community resources for reentry and combating recidivism works. What I'm hearing coming from too many political sectors at the moment is that emotional, tough on crime, it feels good to have revenge and retribution against a perpetrator. There's a great documentary. What's it called? It's the documentary about the Norway prisons, and they compare that with Attica. And then there's a prison in North Dakota. And the superintendent at this North Dakota prison says, look, I get it. The emotional response is very tempting. You know, somebody commits a crime against you and you want the revenge, you want the retribution. I get that. But we're not the Department of Emotions, she said. We're the Department of Corrections. And so we have to take a different task, and that task has to be data-driven and it has to work on evidence. I think the other thing is we just really have to be honest and sober about our describing the political moments that we're in. That they are predicated too frequently on fear. I mean, people can puff up all they want as if they're full of courage, but our political moment is one of fear. And I think FDR was absolutely right to say the only thing to fear is fear itself. So we have to quit pretending that we're courageous when we're so frequently characterized by fear. And then I think the third thing is respect. Being able to listen to somebody else by attending to their story, by thinking that everybody has a story. Lieutenant Chris Sell is not just a cop. She's a human being, you know, who I learned about. She's from Montana, you know, what she's doing right now.
He learned to like me.
Right, exactly. And, that's difficult. Those aren't simple things, you know. I mean, the evidence and the data is a simple thing. But we have that evidence and data. Why aren't people listening to it? Because they're scared, and because there's a lack of respect. You know, whether it's immigrants or gay people or Islamic people or even college professors, right? There's such anti-intellectualism out there that people have an automatic suspicion against professors. But if we can realize that, you know, our genealogies are a little bit more connected than we realize, then some kind of respect can open up.
So what I would ask people is, the professor here probably knows who wrote this theory, and I don't. But there is this theory about politics that is kind of my home base, and that's that we all mentally step behind this curtain from where we are in society now. And we make policy as though we don't know which player we are when we go back to our lives. We make policy not knowing if we're going to be the criminal when we come out the other side, or are we going to be the judge, or are we going to be the police officer, or are we going to be the crime victim? And to try and intellectually compartmentalize yourself that when we emerge, we'll have some role in this policy, but you don't know which that's going to be, which one it's going to be. And I think that that makes us take a step back to that viewpoint that I could be the abused as a child, dyslexic, borderline mentally ill person who is contacted by the police. Or I could be the police officer, or I could be the police officer's wife that is potentially widowed, or I could be the owner of the store who has been unwillingly feeding me for a year. Who am I going to be? And if you don't know, I think you try and walk through that policy with respect for all of those positions. Mm-hmm. And that's not easy. It's not easy. But too often, like, we come at this policy making when we've already lived a privileged life. And I so appreciate how much people have thanked me for my service, but I can't take a lot of credit for hitting a home run when I was born on second base. I was born into a non-abusive family that put education first, and I got a lot of support, and I really benefited from the accidental positioning of my birth. And if I always make policy from that perspective, then I'm not going to necessarily be fair to people that didn't win the lottery like I did.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really hard to underappreciate and undervalue the – or overstate the importance of, like, the kind of community we were able to engender, the Juno Reentry Coalition. I mean, Kara Nelson, Chris Sell, me, you know, Christina Love, Talia Ames, Ricky Annalino. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, I know Ricky Annalino feels a lot like me as well, you know. I mean, and, you know, I was talking to him not too long ago, and he was like, yeah, about you. Like, she's incredible. She's incredible.
Well, I think that we found common ground. We came from not even wanting to listen to each other speak to agreeing on 90% of where we were trying to go.
Yeah.
And no reporter covering those meetings would have really enjoyed taking headlines out of that. It's not really that exciting. But it is the hard work. Mm-hmm. And I know that Saul and I care so much about Juno, and I care so much about Alaska, that I hope those consensus builders find some backing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow. You too? I'm not really sure what else to ask. I think you kind of covered it all. Are we missing anything? Anything either of you would like to ask each other, or anything? I know it's a very big topic.
Yeah. I just want to reiterate that I think that this is exactly the kind of story that the community needs to hear at this moment. You know, that respect and courage can be mustered, and real change and perspective can be had. I really love what Chris was just saying about making policy and not knowing where you're going to be. Because I'm thinking right now, you know, the current governor is talking about privatizing prisons and sending inmates out of state again. You know, we did that. But thinking about, man, how tough is that if you're separated from your family, you're in Colorado or Arizona, wherever you're at, put yourself in those shoes as well, you know. But and then, you know, yeah, that's the emphasis I typically take. So that's why it's always very valuable for Chris to say, put yourself in the widow's position, you know. I mean, so that's not my default position. So it's very important to have that reminder and to think about that seriously.
Okay. I'm going to take some pictures, if I may, and if you think of anything
else.
Well,
I do have one thing to add, is that the people in Juneau, like I saw at the AWARE benefit last night, are such a caring, so educated about social issues, so intelligent, so educated. I really think that the vast majority of people really do want to create a system that's respectful of everyone. Mm-hmm. And we are getting lost in extreme statements from mm-hmm. every angle, and that's not helpful, and it's also not what most people want. Because right. I know a lot of people in Juneau, and this town is a community of genuinely good people. Mm-hmm. And I think if there's any town that can have a respectful discourse about this, it's Juneau.
Yeah, yeah, it's awesome.
I'm just going to take a bunch of pictures, if I may.
Sure, if I can take a selfie.